3. How many beams do there be, Susanna of New York?
6.
Susanna said, at least there were. I guess now there are only 2 that... Mia waved a hand impatiently, as if to say, don't waste my time.
6, aye. And when the beams were created out of that greater discordia, the soup of creation, some, including the many, call the over and some call the prim, what made them?
I don't know, Susanna said. Was it God, do you think?
Perhaps there is a God, but the beams rose from the prim on the airs of magic, Susanna. The true magic which passed long ago. Was it God that made magic, or was it magic that made God?
I know not. It's a question for philosophers, and mothering's my job. But once upon a time, all was discordia, and from it, strong and all crossing at a single unifying point, came the 6 beams. There was magic to hold them steady for eternity. But when the magic left from all there is but the Dark Tower, which some have called Can Calix, the Hall of Resumption, men despaired. When the age of magic passed, the age of machines came.
North Central Positronics, Susanna murmured. Dipolar computers. Slow trans engines. She paused.
Blaine the Mono. But not in our world.
No? Do you say your world is exempt?
What about the sign in the hotel lobby?
The pokeberry popped.
Mia stripped it and gobbled it, drizzling juice through a knowing grin.
I had an idea you couldn't read, Susanna said. This was beside the point, but it was all she could think of to say. Her mind kept returning to the image of the baby, to those brilliant blue eyes. Gunslinger's eyes.
Aye, but I know my numbers. And when it comes to your mind, I read very well.
Do you say you don't recall the sign in the hotel lobby? Would you tell me that?
Of course she remembered. According to the sign, the Plaza Park would be part of an organization called Sombra North Central in just another month. And when she'd said, not in our world, of course she'd been thinking of 1964. The world of black and white television, absurdly bulky, room-sized computers, and Alabama cops more than willing to sic the dogs on black marchers for voting rights. Things had changed greatly in the intervening 35 years. The Eurasian desk clerk's combination TV and typewriter, for instance. How did Susanna know that wasn't a dipolar computer run by some form of slow trans engine? She did not.
Go on, she told Mia.
Mia shrugged. You doom yourselves, Susanna. You seem positively bent on it, and the root is always the same. Your faith fails you, and you replace it with rational thought. But there is no love in thought. Nothing that lasts in deduction. Only death in rationalism.
What does this have to do with your chap?
I don't know. There's much I don't know. She raised a hand, forestalling Susanna before Susanna could speak. And no, I'm not playing for time or trying to lead you away from what you'd know. I'm speaking as my heart tells me. Would you hear or not?
Susanna nodded. She'd hear this. For a little longer, at least. But if it didn't turn back to the baby soon, she'd turn it back in that direction herself.
The magic went away. Merlin retired to his cave in one world, the Sword of Eld gave way to the pistols of the gunslingers in another, and the magic went away. And across the arc of years, great alchemists, great scientists, and great, what, technicians, I think? Great men of thought, anyway, that's what I mean, great men of deduction, these came together and created the machines which ran the beams. They were great machines, but they were mortal machines. They replaced the magic with machines, do you ken it? And now the machines are failing. In some worlds, great plagues have decimated whole populations.
Susanna nodded.
We saw one of those, she said quietly. They called it the superflu. The Crimson King's breakers are only hurrying along a process that's already in train. The machines are going mad. You've seen this for yourself. The men believed there would always be more men like them to make more machines.
None of them foresaw what's happened. This universal exhaustion. The world has moved on. Aye, lady, it has, and left no one to replace the machines which hold up the last magic in creation. For the Prim has receded long since. The magic is gone, and the machines are failing. Soon enough the Dark Tower will fall. Perhaps there'll be time for one splendid moment of universal, rational thought before the darkness rules forever. Wouldn't that be nice? Won't the Crimson King be destroyed too, when the tower falls? Him and all his crew? The guys with the bleeding holes in their foreheads? He has been promised his own kingdom, where he'll rule forever, tasting his own special pleasures. Distaste had crept into Mia's voice. Fear, too, perhaps. Promised? Promised by whom? Who is more powerful than he? Lady, I know not. Perhaps this is only what he has promised himself. Mia shrugged. Her eyes wouldn't quite meet Susanna's. Can nothing prevent the fall of the tower? Not even your gunslinger friend hopes to prevent it, Mia said, only to slow it down by freeing the breakers and, perhaps, slaying the Crimson King. Save it. Save it. Oh, delight. Did he ever tell you that was his quest? Susanna considered this and shook her head. If Roland had ever said that in so many words, she couldn't remember. And she was sure she would have. No, Mia went on, for he won't lie to his quartet unless he has to. 'Tis his pride. What he wants of the tower is only to see it. Then she added, rather grudgingly, oh, perhaps to enter it, and climb to the room at the top. His ambition may strike so far. He may dream of standing on its allure as we hunker on this one, and chant the names of his fallen comrades and of his line all the way back to Arthur Eld. But save it? No, good lady. Only a return of the magic could possibly save it, and, as you yourself well know, your din deals only in lead. Never since crossing the worlds had Susanna heard Roland's trade of hand cast in such a paltry light. It made her feel sad and angry, but she hid her feelings as best she could. Tell me how your chap can be Roland's son, for I would hear. Aye, 'tis a good trick, but one the old people of River Crossing could have explained to you, I've no doubt. Susanna started at that. How do you know so much of me? Because you are possessed, Mia said, and I am your possessor, sure. I can look through any of your memories that I like. I can read what your eyes see. Now be quiet and listen if you would learn, for I sense our time has grown short. 4. This is what Susanna's demon told her. There are 6 beams, as you did say, but there are 12 guardians, one for each end of each beam. This, for we're still on it, is the beam of Shardik. Were you to go beyond the tower, it would become the beam of Maturin, the great turtle upon whose shell the world rests. Similarly, there are but 6 demon elementals, one for each beam. Below them is the whole invisible world, those creatures left behind on the beach of existence when the Prim receded. There are speaking demons, demons of house, which some call ghosts, ill-sick demons, which some, makers of machines and worshippers of the great false god rationality, if it does you, call disease. Many small demons, but only 6 demon elementals. Yet as there are 12 guardians for the 6 beams, there are 12 demon aspects, for each demon elemental is both male and female. Susanna began to see where this was going, and felt a sudden sinking in her guts. From the naked bristle of rocks beyond the allure, in what Mia called the Discordia, there came a dry, feverish cackle of laughter. This unseen humorist was joined by a second, a third, a fourth, and 5th. Suddenly, it seemed that the whole world was laughing at her. And perhaps with good reason, for it was a good joke. But how could she have known? As the hyenas or whatever they were, cackled. She said, "You're telling me that the demon elementals are hermaphrodites. That's why they're sterile, because they're both. I, in the place of the oracle, your din, had intercourse with one of these demon elementals in order to gain information, what's called prophecy in the high speech. He had no reason to think the oracle was anything but a succubus, such as those that sometimes exist in the lonely places." "Right," Susanna said, "just a run-of-the-mill demon sexpot."
"If you like," Mia said.
And this time when she offered Susanna a pokeberry, Susanna took it and began to roll it between her palms, warming the skin. She still wasn't hungry, but her mouth was dry. So dry. "The demon took the gunslinger's seed as female and gave it back to you as male." "When we were in the speaking ring," Susanna said dismally. She was remembering how the pouring rain had pounded against her upturned face, the sense of invisible hands on her shoulders, and then the thing's engorgement filling her up and at the same time seeming to tear her apart. The worst part had been the coldness of the enormous cock inside her. At the time, she thought it was like being fucked by an icicle. And how had she gotten through it? By summoning Detta, of course. By calling on the bitch, victor in 100 nasty little sex skirmishes fought in the parking lots of 24 roadhouses and county-line honky-tonks. Detta, who had trapped it. "It tried to get away," she told Mia. "Once it figured out it had its cock caught in a damn Chinese finger-puller, it tried to get away." "If it had wanted to get away," Mia said quietly, "it would have." "Why would it bother fooling me?" Susanna asked, but she didn't need Mia to answer that question, not now. "Because it had needed her, of course. It had needed her to carry the baby. Roland's baby. Roland's doom." "You know everything you need to know about the chap," Mia said, "don't you?" Susanna supposed she did. A demon had taken in Roland's seed while female, had stored it somehow, and then shot it into Susanna Dina's mail. Mia was right. She knew what she needed to know. "I've kept my promise," Mia said. "Let's go back. The cold's not good for the chap." "Just a minute longer," Susanna said. She held up the pokeberry. Golden fruit now bulged through ruptures in the orange skin. "My berry just popped. Let me eat it. I have another question. Eat and ask, and be quick about both. Who are you? Who are you really? Are you this demon? Does she have a name, by the way? She and he, do they have a name?" "No," Mia said. "Elementals have no need of names. They are what they are. Am I a demon? Is that what you'd know? Yar, I suppose I am, or I was. All that is vague now, like a dream. And you're not me. Or are you?" Mia didn't answer, and Susanna realized that she probably didn't know. Mia? Low, musing. Mia was hunkering against the Merlin with her serape tucked between her knees. Susanna could see that her ankles were swollen and felt a moment's pity for the woman. Then she squashed it. This was no time for pity, for there was no truth in it. "You ain't nothing but the babysitter girl." The reaction was all she'd hoped for and more. Mia's face registered shock, then anger, hell, fury. "You lie! I'm this chap's mother! And when he comes, Susanna, there will be no more combing the world for breakers, for my chap will be the greatest of them all, able to break both of the remaining beams all by himself." Her voice had filled with pride that sounded alarmingly close to insanity. "My Mordred! Do you hear me?" "Oh, yes," Susanna said, "I hear. And you're actually going to go trotting right to those who've made it their business to pull down the tower, aren't you? They call you come." She paused, then finished with deliberate softness. "And when you get to them, they'll take your chap and thank you very much, and then send you back into the soup you came from."
"Nay, I shall have the raising of him, for so they have promised,"
Mia crossed her arms protectively over her belly. He's mine. I'm his mother, and I shall have the raising of him. Girl, why don't you get real? Do you think they'll keep their word? Them? How can you see so much and not see that? Susanna knew the answer, of course. Motherhood itself had deluded her. Why would they not let me raise him? Mia asked shrilly. Who better than Mia, who was made for only two things, to bear a son and raise him? But you're not just you, Susanna said. You're like the children of the Kala, and just about everything else my friends and I have run into along the way. You're a twin, Mia. I'm your other half, your lifeline. You see the world through my eyes and breathe through my lungs. I had to carry the chap because you couldn't, could you? You're as sterile as the big boys, and once they've got your kid, their A-bomb of a breaker, they'll get rid of you if only so they can get rid of me. I have their promise, she said. Her face was downcast, set in its stubbornness. Turn it around, Susanna said. Turn it around, I beg. If I were in your place and you in mine, what would you think if I spoke of such a promise? I'd tell you to stop your blabbering tongue. Who are you, really? Where in the hell did they get you? Was it like a newspaper ad you answered? Surrogate mother wanted? Good benefits? Short term of employment? Who are you, really? Shut up! Susanna leaned forward on her haunches. This position was ordinarily exquisitely uncomfortable for her, but she'd forgotten both her discomfort and the half-eaten pokeberry in her hand. Come on, she said, her voice taking on the rasping tones of Detta Walker. Come on and take off your blindfold, honey bunch, just like you made me take off mine. Tell the truth and spit in the devil's eye. Who the fuck are you? I don't know, Mia screamed. And below them the jackals hidden in the rocks screamed back. Only their screams were laughter. I don't know. I don't know who I am. Does that satisfy? It did not. And Susanna was about to press on and press harder when Detta Walker spoke up. 5. This is what Susanna's other demon told her.
Baby doll, you need to think about this a little, seem to me. She can't. She's stone dumb. Can't read. Can't cipher more than just a little. Ain't been to Moore House. Ain't been to no house. But you have, Miss Odetta Holmes. Been to Columbia, la-di-da, the gem of the ocean. Ain't we just so fine? You need to think about how she pregnant, for one thing. She say she done fucked Roland out of his jizz, then turned male into the demon of the ring and shot it into you, and then you carrying it, you tossing all those nasty things she made you eat down your throat. So where's she in all this now? That what Detta like to know. How come she's sitting there pregnant under that greaser blanket she wear? Is it more that, what you call it, visualization technique?
Susanna didn't know. She only knew that Mia was looking at her with suddenly narrowed eyes. She was doubtless picking up some of this monologue. How much? Not much at all, that was Susanna's bet. Maybe a word here and there, but mostly it was just quack. And in any case, Mia certainly acted like the baby's mother. Baby Mordred. It was like a Charles Adams cartoon.
That she do, Detta mused. She act like a mommy. She wrapped around it root and branch. You right about that much.
But maybe, Susanna thought, that was just her nature. Maybe once you got beyond the mothering instinct, there was no Mia. A cold hand reached out and seized Susanna's wrist.
Who is it? Is it that nasty talking one? If it is, banish her. She scares me.
She still scared Susanna a little, in all truth, but not as much as when she'd first come to accept that Detta was real. They hadn't become friends and probably never would, but it was clear that Detta Walker could be a powerful ally. She was more than mean. Once you got past the idiotic Butterfly McQueen accent, she was shrewd.
This Mia make a mighty powerful ally her own self. If you could get her on your side, ain't hardly nothing in the world as powerful as a pissed-off mommy.
We're going back, Mia said. I've answered your questions. The cold's bad for the baby, and the mean one's here. Palaver's done. But Susanna shook off her grip and moved back a little, out of Mia's immediate reach. In the gap between the Merlins, the cold wind knifed through her light shirt, but it also seemed to clear her mind and refresh her thinking. Part of her is me, because she has access to my memories. Eddie's ring, The people of River Crossing, Blaine, the Mono, but she's got to be more than me as well, because...
Go on, girl, you ain't doing bad, but you slow.
Because she knows all this other stuff as well. She knows about the demons, both the little ones and the elementals. She knows how the beams came into being, sort of, and about this magical soup of creation, the Prim. As far as I ever knew, Prim's a word you use for girls who are always yanking their skirts down over their knees. She didn't get that other meaning from me. It occurred to her what this conversation was like. Parents studying their new baby, their new chap. He's got your nose, yes, but he's got your eyes, and, but my goodness, where did he get that hair? Detta said,
and she also got friends back in New York. Don't forget that. At least she want to think they're her friends.
So she's someone or something else as well. Someone from the invisible world of house demons and ill six. But who? Is she really one of the elementals? Detta laughed.
She say so, but she lying about that, sugar. I know she is.
Then what is she? What was she before she was Mia? All at once a phone, amplified to almost ear-splitting shrillness, began to ring. It was so out of place on this abandoned castle tower that at first Susanna didn't know what it was. The things out there in the Discordia, jackals, hyenas, whatever they were, had been subsiding, but with the advent of this sound, they began to cackle and shriek again. Mia, daughter of none, mother of Mordred, knew that ringing for what it was immediately, however. She came forward. Susanna at once felt this world waver and lose its reality. It seemed almost to freeze and become something like a painting. Not a very good one, either. No, she shouted, and threw herself at Mia. But Mia, pregnant or not, scratched up or not, swollen ankles or no swollen ankles, overpowered her easily. Roland had shown them several hand-to-hand tricks. The Detta part of her had crowed with delight at the nastiness of them. But they were useless against Mia. She parried each before Susanna had done more than get started. Sure, yes, of course, she knows your tricks, just like she knows about Aunt Talitha in River Crossing and Topsy the Sailor in Lud, because she has access to your memories, because she is, at least to some extent, you.
And here her thoughts ended, because Mia had twisted her arms up behind her, and oh, dear God, the pain was enormous.
Ain't you just the most babyish cunt? Detta said with a kind of genial, panting contempt, and before Susanna could reply, an amazing thing happened. The world ripped open like a brittle piece of paper. This rip extended from the dirty cobbles of the Allure's floor to the nearest Merlin and then on up into the sky. It raced into that star-shot firmament and tore the crescent moon in two. There was a moment for Susanna to think that this was it. One or both of the final two beams had snapped and the tower had fallen. Then, through the rip, she saw two women lying on one of the twin beds in room 1919 of the Plaza Park Hotel. Their arms were around each other and their eyes were shut. They were dressed in identical blood-stained shirts and blue jeans. Their features were the same, but one had legs below the knee and straight silky hair and white skin. "Don't you mess with me," Mia panted in her ear. Susanna could feel a fine, tickling spray of saliva. "Don't you mess with me, or with my chap, because I'm stronger, do you hear? I'm stronger!"
There was no doubt about that, Susanna thought as she was propelled toward the widening hole, at least for now. She was pushed through the rip in reality. For a moment her skin seemed simultaneously on fire and coated with ice. Somewhere, the toad ash chimes were ringing, and then... 6. She sat up on the bed. One woman, not two, but at least one with legs. Susanna was shoved, reeling, to the back, Mia in charge now, Mia reaching for the phone, at first getting it wrong way up and then reversing it. Hello? Hello? Hello, Mia. My name is... She overrode him.
Are you going to let me keep my baby? This bitch inside me says you're not.
There was a pause, first long and then too long. Susanna felt Mia's fear, first a rivulet and then a flood.
You don't have to feel that way, she tried to tell her. You're the one with what they want, with what they need. Don't you see that?
Hello, are you there? Gods, are you there? Please tell me you're still there.
I'm here, the man's voice said calmly. Shall we start again, Mia, daughter of Nun? Or shall I ring off until you're feeling a little more yourself?
No, no, don't do that, don't do that, I beg.
You won't interrupt me again? Because there's no reason for unseemliness.
I promise.
My name is Richard P. Sayre. A name Susanna knew, but from where? You know where you need to go, don't you?
Yes.
Eager now, eager to please.
The Dixie Pig, 61st and Lexingworth.
Lexington, Sayre said. Odetta Holmes can help you find it, I'm sure. Susanna wanted to scream, that's not my name. She kept silent instead. This Sayre would like her to scream, wouldn't he? Would like her to lose control.
Are you there, Odetta?
Pleasantly teasing. Are you there, you interfering bitch? She kept silent.
She's in there, Mia said. I don't know why she's not answering. I'm not holding her just now.
Oh, I think I know why, Sayre said indulgently. She doesn't like that name, for one thing. Then, in a reference Susanna didn't get, don't call me Clay no more. Clay my slave name. Call me Muhammad Ali. Right, Susanna? Or was that after your time? A little after, I think. Sorry. Time can be so confusing, can't it? Never mind. I have something to tell you in a minute, my dear. You won't like it very much, I fear, but I think you should know. Susanna kept silent. It was getting harder. As for the immediate future of your chap, Mia, I'm surprised you'd even feel it necessary to ask, Sayre told her. He was a smoothie, whoever he was, his voice containing exactly the right amount of outrage. The king keeps his promises, unlike some I could name. And issues of our integrity aside, think of the practical issues. Who else should have the keeping of perhaps the most important child to ever be born, including Christ, including Buddha, including the Prophet Muhammad? To who else's breast, if I may be crude, would we trust his suck? Music to her ears, Susanna thought dismally. All the things she's been thirsting to hear, and why? Because she is mother.
You'd trust him to me, Mia cried. Only to me, of course. Thank you, thank you.
Susanna spoke at last, told her not to trust him, and was, of course, roundly ignored. I'd no more lie to you than break a promise to my own mother, said the voice on the phone.
Did you ever have one, sugar?
Detta wanted to know. Even though the truth sometimes hurts, lies have a way of coming back to bite us, don't they? The truth of this matter is you won't have your chap for long, Mia. His childhood won't be like that of other children. Normal children.
I know. Oh, I know.
But for the 5 years you do have him, or perhaps 7, it might be as many as 7, he'll have the best of everything. From you, of course, but also from us. Our interference will be minimal. Detta Walker leaped forward, as quick and as nasty as a grease burn. She was only able to take possession of Susanna Dean's vocal cords for a moment, but it was a precious moment.
That's right, darling, that's right, she cackled. He won't come in your mouth or get it in your hair.
Shut that bitch up,
Sayre whipcracked. And Susanna felt the jolt as Mia shoved Detta head over heels, but still cackling, to the back of their shared mind again. Once more into the brig.
Had my say, though, damn if I didn't, Detta cried. I told that honky mofo.
Sayre's voice in the telephone's earpiece was cold and clear. Mia, do you have control or not?
Yes, yes, I do.
Then don't let that happen again.
I won't.
And somewhere it felt like above her, although there were no real directions here at the back of the shared mind, something clanged shut. It sounded like iron. We really are in the brig, she told Detta. But Detta just went on laughing. Susanna thought, I'm pretty sure I know who she is anyway. Besides me, that is. This truth seemed obvious to her. The part of Mia that wasn't either Susanna or something summoned from the void world to do the Crimson King's bidding, surely the third part really was the Oracle, elemental or not. The female force that had at first tried to molest Jake and then had taken Roland instead. That sad, craving spirit. She finally had the body she needed, one capable of carrying the chap.
Odetta? Sayre's voice, teasing and cruel. Or Susanna, if you like that better. I promised you news, didn't I? It's kind of a good news, bad news thing, I'm afraid. Would you like to hear it?
Susanna held her silence.
The bad news is that Mia's chap may not be able to fulfill the destiny of his name by killing his father after all. The good news is that Roland will almost surely be dead in the next few minutes. As for Eddie, I'm afraid there's no question. He doesn't have either Yordin's reflexes or his battle experience. My dear, you're going to be a widow very soon. That's the bad news.
She could hold her silence no longer, and Mia let her speak. You lie about everything.
Not at all. Sayre said calmly, and Susanna realized where she knew that name from, the end of Callahan's story, Detroit, where he'd violated his church's most sacred teaching and committed suicide to keep from falling into the hands of the vampires. Callahan had jumped out of a skyscraper window to avoid that particular fate. He had landed first in Midworld and gone from there via the unfound door into the Kala borderlands. And what he'd been thinking, the pair had told them, was, they don't get to win. They don't get to win. And he was right about that. Right, goddammit. But if Eddie died, we knew where Yordin and your husband would be most likely to end up, should they be swept through a certain doorway, Sayre told her. And calling certain people, beginning with a chap named Enrico Balazar. I assure you, Susanna, that was easy.
Susanna heard the sincerity in his voice. If he didn't mean what he said, then he was the world's best liar. How could you find such a thing out? Susanna asked. When there was no answer, she opened her mouth to ask the question again. Before she could, she was tumbled backward once more. Whatever Mia might have been once, she had grown to incredible strength inside Susanna.
Is she gone? Sayre was asking.
Yes, gone, in the back.
Servile. Eager to please. Then come to us, Mia. The sooner you come to us, the sooner you can look your chap in the face.
Yes!
Mia cried, delirious with joy, and Susanna caught a sudden brilliant glimpse of something. It was like peeking beneath the hem of a circus tent at some bright wonder, or a dark one. What she saw was as simple as it was terrible.
Per Callahan. Buying a piece of salami from a shopkeeper, a Yankee shopkeeper. One who ran a certain general store in the town of East Stoneham, Maine, in the year of 1977. Callahan had told them all this story in the rectory, and Mia had been listening.
Comprehension came like a red sun rising on a field where thousands have been slaughtered.
Susanna rushed forward again, unmindful of Mia's strength, screaming it over and over again, Bitch! Betraying bitch! Murdering bitch! You told them where the door would send them! Where it would send Eddie and Roland! Oh, you bitch!
7.
Mia was strong, but unprepared for this new attack. It was especially ferocious because Detta had joined her own murderous energy to Susanna's understanding. For a moment, the interloper was pushed backward, eyes wide. In the hotel room, the telephone dropped from Mia's hand. She staggered drunkenly across the carpet, almost tripped over one of the beds, then whirled about like a tipsy dancer. Susanna slapped at her, and red marks appeared on her cheek like exclamation points.
"Slapping myself, that's all I'm doing," Susanna thought. Beating up the equipment, how stupid is that? But she couldn't help it. The enormity of what Mia had done, the betraying enormity.
inside, in some battle ring which was not quite physical, but not entirely mental either, Mia was finally able to clutch Susanna Detta by the throat and drive her back. Mia's eyes were still wide with shock at the ferocity of the assault, and perhaps with shame as well. Susanna hoped she was able to feel shame, that she hadn't gone beyond that. "I did what I had to do," Mia repeated as she forced Susanna back into the brig. "It's my chap. Every hand is against me. I did what I had to do." "You traded Eddie and Roland for your monster. That's what you did," Susanna screamed. "Based on what you overheard and then passed on, Sayre was sure they'd use the door to go after Tower, wasn't he? And how many has he set against them?" The only answer was that iron clang. Only this time it was followed by a second and a third. Mia had had the hands of her hostess clamped around her throat and was consequently taking no chances. This time the brig's door had been triple-locked. Brig! Hell, might as well call it the Black Hole of Calcutta. "When I get out of here, I'll go back to the Dogon and disable all the switches," she cried. "I can't believe I tried to help you. Well, fuck that. Have it on the street for all of me." "You can't get out," Mia replied, almost apologetically. "Later, if I can, I'll leave you in peace." "What kind of peace will there be for me with Eddie dead? No wonder you wanted to take his ring off. How could you bear to have it lie against your skin, knowing what you'd done?" Mia picked up the telephone and listened, but Richard P. Sayre was no longer there. Probably had places to go and diseases to spread, Susanna thought. Mia replaced the telephone in its cradle, looked around at the empty, sterile room the way people do when they won't be coming back to a place and want to make sure they've taken everything that matters. She patted one pocket of her jeans and felt the little wad of cash. Touched the other and felt the lump that was the turtle, the Sholpada. "I'm sorry," Mia said. "I have to take care of my chap. Every hand is against me now." "That's not true," Susanna said from the locked room where Mia had thrown her. And where was it, really? In the deepest, darkest dungeons of the castle on the abyss? Probably. Did it matter? "I was on your side. I helped you. I stopped your damn labor when you needed it stopped. And look what you did. How could you ever be so cowardly and low?" Mia paused with her hand on the room's doorknob, her cheeks flushing a dull red. Yes, she was ashamed, all right. But shame wouldn't stop her. Nothing would stop her. Until, that was, she found herself betrayed and turned by Sayre and his friends. Thinking of that inevitability gave Susanna no satisfaction at all. "You're damned," she said. "You know that, don't you?" "I don't care," Mia said. "An eternity in hell's a fair price to pay for one look in my chap's face. Hear me well, I beg." And then, carrying Susanna and Detta with her, Mia opened the hotel room door, re-entered the corridor, and took her first steps on her course toward the Dixie Pig, where terrible surgeons waited to deliver her of her equally terrible chap. Stave. Kamala mocks Nix, "You're in a nasty fix. To take the hand in a traitor's glove is to grasp a sheaf of sticks." Response. Kamala comes six, nothing there but thorns and sticks. When you find your hand in a traitor's glove, you're in a nasty fix.
Seventh stanza. The Ambush. 1. Roland Deschain was the last of Gilead's last great band of warriors, for good reason. With his queerly romantic nature, his lack of imagination, and his deadly hands, he had ever been the best of them. Now he had been invaded by arthritis, but there was no dry twist in his ears or eyes. He heard the thud of Eddie's head against the side of the unfound door as they were sucked through, and, ducking down at the last split second, only just avoided having his own skull broken in by the door's top jamb. He heard the sound of birds, at first strange and distant, like birds singing in a dream, then immediate and prosaic, and completely there. Sunlight struck his face and should have dazzled him blind, coming as he was from the dimness of the cave. But Roland had turned his eyes into slits the moment he'd seen that bright light, had done it without thinking. Had he not, He surely would have missed the circular flash from 2 o'clock as they landed on hard-packed, oil-darkened earth. Eddie would have died for sure. Maybe both of them would have died. In Roland's experience, only 2 things glared with that perfect, brilliant circularity. Eyeglasses and the long sight of a weapon. The gunslinger grabbed Eddie beneath the arm as unthinkingly as he'd slitted his eyes against the glare of onrushing sunlight. He'd felt the tension in the younger man's muscles as their feet left the rock and bone-littered floor of the doorway cave, and he felt them go slack when Eddie's head connected with the side of the unfound door. But Eddie was groaning, still trying to talk, so he was at least partly aware. "Eddie, to me!" Roland bellowed, scrambling to his feet. Bitter agony exploded in his right hip and raced almost all the way down to his knee, but he gave no sign. Barely registered it, in fact. He hauled Eddie with him toward a building, some building, and past what even Roland recognized as oil or gasoline pumps. These were marked Mobile instead of Citgo or Sunoco, 2 other names with which the gunslinger was familiar. Eddie was semi-conscious at best. His left cheek was drenched with blood from a laceration in his scalp. Nevertheless, he put his legs to work as best he could and stumbled up 3 wooden steps to what Roland now recognized as a general store. It was quite a bit smaller than Took's, but otherwise not much. A limber whip-crack of sound came from behind and slightly to the right. The shooter was close enough for Roland to feel confident that if he had heard the sound of the shot, the man with the rifle had already missed. Something passed within an inch of his ear, making its own perfectly clear sound. Mzzz! The glass in the little mercantile's front door shattered inward. The sign, which had been hanging there, were open, so come in and visit, jumped and twisted. "Roland!" Eddie's voice, weak and distant, sounded as if it were coming through a mouthful of mush. "Roland, well, who, off?" This last a grunt of surprise as Roland threw him flat inside the door and landed on top of him. Now came another of those limber whip-cracks. There was a gunner with an extremely high-powered rifle out there. Roland heard someone shout, "Aw, fuck at, Jack," and a moment later a speed shooter, what Eddie and Jake called a machine gun, opened up. The dirty display windows on both sides of the door came crashing down in bright shards. The paperwork which had been posted inside the glass, town notices, Roland had no doubt, went flying. 2 women and a gent of going on elderly years were the only customers in the store's aisles. All 3 were turned toward the front, toward Roland and Eddie, and on their faces was the eternal, uncomprehending look of the gunless civilian. Roland sometimes thought it a grass-eating look, as though such folk, those in Colobrin Sturgis mostly no different, were sheep instead of people. "Down!" Roland bellowed from where he lay on his semi-conscious and now breathless companion. "For the love of your gods, get down!" The going-on elderly gent, who was wearing a checked flannel shirt in spite of the store's warmth, let go of the can he'd been holding, there was a picture of a tomato on it, and dropped. The 2 women did not, and the speed shooter's second burst killed them both, caving in the chest of one and blowing off the top of the other's head. The chest-shot woman went down like a sack of grain. The one who'd been head-shot took 2 blind, blundering steps toward Roland, blood spewing from where her hair had been like lava from an erupting volcano. Outside the store, a 2nd and 3rd speed shooter began, filling the day with noise, filling the air above them with a deadly crisscross of slugs. The woman who'd lost the top of her head spun around 2x in a final dance step, arms flailing, and then collapsed. Roland went for his gun and was relieved to find it still in its holster. The reassuring sandalwood grip. So that much was well. The gamble had paid off, and he and Eddie certainly were in Todash. The gunners had seen them very well. More had been waiting for them. "Move in!" someone was screaming. "Move in! Move in! Don't give them a chance to find their peckers! Move in, you katsaros!" "Eddie!" Roland roared. "Eddie, you have to help me now!" "Is?" Faint. Bemused, Eddie looking at him with only 1 eye, the right. The left was temporarily drowned in blood from his scalp wound. Roland reached out and slapped him hard enough to make blood fly from his hair. "Harriers, coming to kill us, kill all here!" Eddie's visible eye cleared. It happened fast.
Roland saw the effort that took not to regain his wits but to regain them at such speed, and despite a head that must be pounding monstrously, and took a moment to be proud of Eddie. He was Cuthbert Allgood all over again, Cuthbert to the life.
"What the hell is this?" someone called in a cracked, excited voice. "Just what in the blue hell is this?"
"Down," Roland said, without looking around. "If you want to live, get on the floor."
"Do what he says, Chip,"
someone else replied, probably, Roland thought, the man who'd been holding the can with the tomato on it. Roland crawled through litters of broken glass from the door, feeling pricks and prinks of pain as some cut his knees and knuckles, not caring. A bullet buzzed past his temple. Roland ignored that, too. Outside was a brilliant summer day. In the foreground were the two oil pumps with "Mobil" printed on them. To one side was an old car, probably belonging to either the women shoppers, who'd never need it again, or to Mr. Flannel Shirt. Beyond the pumps and the oiled dirt of the parking area was a paved country road, and on the other side of that a little cluster of buildings painted a uniform gray. One was marked Town Office, one Stoneham Fire and Rescue. The third and largest was the Town Garage. The parking area in front of these buildings was also paved. "Metalled" was Roland's word for it. And a number of vehicles had been parked there, one the size of a large bucka wagon. From behind them came more than half a dozen men at full charge. One hung back, and Roland recognized him. Enrico Balazar's ugly lieutenant, Jack Andolini. The gunslinger had seen this man die, gunshot and then eaten alive by the carnivorous lobstrosities which lived in the shallow waters of the Western Sea. But here he was again. Because infinite worlds spun on the axle which was the Dark Tower, and here was another of them. Yet only one world was true. Only one where, when things were finished, they stayed finished. It might be this one. It might not be. In either case, this was no time to worry about it. Up on his knees, Roland opened fire, fanning the trigger of his revolver with the hard ridge of his right hand, aiming first at the boys with the speed shooters. One of them dropped dead on the country road's white center line with blood boiling out of his throat. The second was flung backward all the way to the road's dirt shoulder with a hole between his eyes. Then Eddie was beside him, also on his knees, fanning the trigger of Roland's other gun. He missed at least two of his targets, which wasn't surprising given his condition. Three others dropped to the road, two dead and one screaming, "I'm hit! Ah, Jack, help me! I'm hit in the guts!" Someone grabbed Roland's shoulder, unaware of what a dangerous thing that was to do to a gunslinger, especially one in a firefight.
"Mister, what in the hell?"
Roland took a quick look, saw a 40-ish man wearing both a tie and a butcher's apron, had time to think, shopkeeper, probably the one who gave Pear directions to the post office, and then shoved the man violently backward. A split second later, blood dashed backward from the left side of the man's head. Grooved, the gunslinger judged, but not seriously hurt, at least not yet. If Roland hadn't pushed him, however... Eddie was reloading. Roland did the same, taking a bit longer thanks to the missing fingers on his right hand. Meanwhile, two of the surviving Harriers had taken cover behind one of the old cars on this side of the road. Too close. Not good. Roland could hear the rumble of an approaching motor. He looked back at the fellow who'd been quick-witted enough to drop when Roland told him to, thus avoiding the fate of the ladies.
"You," Roland said, "do you have a gun?"
The man in the flannel shirt shook his head. His eyes were a brilliant blue. Frightened, but not, Roland judged, panicky. In front of this customer, the shopkeeper was sitting up, spread-legged, looking with sickened amazement at the red droplets pattering down and spreading on his white apron.
"Shopkeeper, do you keep a gun?" Roland asked.
Before the shopkeeper could answer, if he was capable of answering, Eddie grabbed Roland's shoulder.
"Sure of a light brigade," he said.
The words came out mushy, but Roland wouldn't have understood the reference in any case. The important thing was that Eddie had seen another six men dashing across the road. This time, they were spread out and zigzagging from side to side.
"Vai, vai, vai!"
Andolini bawled from behind them, sweeping both hands in the air.
"Christ, Roland, that's Trix Postino," Eddie said.
Trix was once more toting an extremely large weapon, although Eddie couldn't be sure it was the oversized M16 he'd called the Wonderful Rambo Machine. In any case, he was no luckier here than he'd been in the shootout at the Leaning Tower. Eddie fired, and Trix went down on top of one of the guys already lying in the road, still firing his assault weapon at them as he did so. This was probably nothing more heroic than a finger spasm, final signals sent from a dying brain, but Roland and Eddie had to throw themselves flat again, and the other five outlaws reached cover behind the old cars on this side of the road. Worse still, backed by covering fire from the vehicles across the street, the vehicles these boys had come in, Roland was quite sure, they would soon be able to turn this little store into a shooting gallery without too much danger to themselves. All of this was too close to what had happened at Jericho Hill. It was time to beat a retreat. The sound of the approaching vehicle continued to swell, a big engine laboring under a heavy load from the sound. What topped the rise to the left of the store was a gigantic truck filled with enormous cut trees. Roland saw the driver's eyes widen and his mouth drop open, and why not? Here in front of this small-town mercantile, where he had doubtless stopped many times for a bottle of beer or ale at the end of a long hot day in the woods, lay half a dozen bleeding bodies scattered in the road like soldiers killed in a battle. Which was, Roland knew, exactly what they were. The big truck's front brakes shrieked. From the rear came the angry dragon chuff of the air brakes. There was an accompanying scream of huge rubber tires, first locking and then smoking black tracks on the metalled surface of the road. The truck's multi-ton load began to slew sideways. Roland saw splinters flying from the trees and into the blue sky as the outlaws on the far side of the road continued to fire heedlessly. There was something almost hypnotic about all this, like watching one of the lost beasts of Eld come tumbling out of the sky with its wings on fire. The truck's horseless front end ran over the first of the bodies. Guts flew in red ropes and splashed the dirt of the shoulder. Legs and arms were torn off. A wheel squashed Trix Postino's head, the sound of his imploding skull like a chestnut bursting in a hot fire. The truck's load broached sideways and began to totter. Wheels fully as high as Roland's shoulders dug in and tossed up clouds of bloody dirt. The truck slid by the store with a majestic lack of speed. The driver was no longer visible in the cab. For a moment, the store and the people inside it were blocked from the superior firepower on the other side of the road. The shopkeeper, Chip, and the surviving customer, Mr. Flannel Shirt, were staring at the broaching truck with identical expressions of helpless amazement. The shopkeeper absently wiped blood from the side of his head and flicked it onto the floor, like water. His wound was worse than Eddie's, Roland judged, yet he seemed unaware of it. Maybe that was good. "Out back," the gunslinger said to Eddie. "Now, good call." Roland grabbed the man in the flannel shirt by the arm. The man's eyes immediately left the truck and went to the gunslinger. Roland nodded toward the back, and the elderly gent nodded back. His unquestioning quickness was an unexpected gift. Outside, the truck's load finally overturned, mashing one of the parked cars, and the harriers hiding behind it, Roland dearly hoped, spilling logs first off the top and then simply spilling them all. There was a gruesome, endless sound of scraping metal that made the gunfire seem puny by comparison. 2. Eddie grabbed the storekeeper just as Roland had grabbed the other man, but Chip showed none of his customer's awareness or instinct for survival. He merely went on staring through the jagged hole where his windows had been, eyes wide with shock and awe as the pulp truck out there entered the final phase of its self-destructive ballet, the cab twisting free of the overloaded carrier and bouncing down the hill beyond the store and into the woods. The load itself went sliding up the right side of the road, creating a huge bow wave of dirt and leaving behind a deep groove of flattened Chevrolet and two more flattened Harriers. There were plenty more where those came from, though, or so it seemed. The gunfire continued. "Come on, Chip, time to split," Eddie said, and this time when he tugged the shopkeeper toward the back of the store, Chip came, still looking back over his shoulder and wiping blood from the side of his face. At the rear of the market, on the left, was an added-on lunchroom with a counter, a few patched stools, three or four tables, and an old lobster pot over a newsstand, which seemed to contain mostly out-of-date girly magazines. As they reached this part of the building, the gunfire from outside intensified. Then it was dwarfed again, this time by an explosion. The pulper's fuel tank, Eddie assumed,
He felt the droning passage of a bullet and saw a round black hole appear in the picture of a lighthouse mounted on the wall.
"Who are those guys?" Chip asked in a perfectly conversational voice. "Who are you? Am I hit? My son was in Vietnam, you know. Did you see that truck?"
Eddie answered none of his questions, just smiled and nodded, and hustled Chip along in Roland's wake. He had absolutely no idea where they were going or how they were going to get out of this fuckery. The only thing he was completely sure of was that Calvin Tower wasn't here, which was probably good. Tower might or might not have brought down this particular batch of hellfire and brimstone, but the hellfire and brimstone was about old Cal. Of that, Eddie had no doubt. If old Cal had only... A darning needle of heat suddenly tore through his arm, and Eddie shouted in surprise and pain. A moment later, another punched him in the calf. His lower right leg exploded into serious pain, and he cried out again.
"Eddie," Roland chanced a look back, "are you—"
"Yeah, fine. Go, go."
Ahead of them now was a cheap fiberboard back wall with three doors in it. One was marked Boys, one Gulls, one Employees Only.
"Employees Only," Eddie shouted.
He looked down and saw a blood-ringed hole in his blue jeans about 3 inches below his right knee. The bullet hadn't exploded the knee itself, which was to the good, but oh, mama, it hurt like the veriest motherfucker of creation. Over his head, a light globe exploded. Glass showered down on Eddie's head and shoulders.
"I'm insured, but God knows if it covers something like this," Chip said in his perfectly conversational voice.
He wiped more blood from his face, then slatted it off his fingertips and onto the floor, where it made a Rorschach ink blot. Bullets buzzed around them. Eddie saw one flip up Chip's collar. Somewhere behind them, Jack Andolini, old Double Ugly, was hollering in Italian. Eddie somehow didn't think he was calling retreat. Roland and the customer in the flannel shirt went through the employees-only door. Eddie followed, pumped up on the wine of adrenaline and still dragging Chip. This was a storeroom, and of quite a good size. Eddie could smell different kinds of grain, some sort of minty tang, and most of all, coffee. Now Mr. Flannel Shirt had taken the lead. Roland followed him quickly down the storeroom's center aisle and between pallets stacked high with canned goods. Eddie limped gamely along after, still hauling the shopkeeper. Old Chip had lost a lot of blood from the wound on the side of his head, and Eddie kept expecting him to pass out, but Chip actually seemed, well, chipper. He was currently asking Eddie what had happened to Ruth Beamer and her sister. If he meant the two women who'd been in the store, Eddie was pretty sure he did, Eddie hoped that Chip wouldn't suddenly regain his memory. There was another door at the back. Mr. Flannel Shirt opened it and started out. Roland hauled him back by the shirt, then went out himself, low. Eddie stood Chip beside Mr. Flannel Shirt and himself just in front of them. Behind them, bullets smacked through the employees-only door, creating startled white eyes of daylight.
"Eddie," Roland grunted, "to me."
Eddie limped out. There was a loading dock here, and beyond it about an acre of unlovely, churned-up ground. Trash barrels had been stacked haphazardly to the right of the dock, and there were two dumpsters to the left, but it didn't look to Eddie Dean as if anyone had worried too much about putting litter in its place. There were also several piles of beer cans, almost big enough to qualify as archaeological middens.
"Nothing like relaxing on the back porch after a hard day at the store," Eddie thought.
Roland was pointing his gun at another oil pump, this one rustier and older than the ones out front. On it was a single word.
"Diesel," Roland said. "Does that mean fuel?" "It does, doesn't it?"
"Yeah," Eddie said. "Chip, does the diesel pump work?"
"Sure.
Sure,"
Chip said in a disinterested tone of voice.
"Lots of guys fill up back here."
"I can run it, mister," said Flannel Shirt. "You better let me, too. It's tetchy. Can you and your buddy cover me?"
"Yes," Roland said. "Pour it in there," and jerked a thumb at the storeroom.
"Hey, no," Chip said, startled.
How long did all these things take? Eddie could not have said, not for sure. All he was aware of was a clarity he had known only once before, while riddling Blaine the Mono. It overwhelmed everything with its brilliance, even the pain in his lower leg, where the tibia might or might not have been chipped by a bullet. He was aware of how funky it smelled back here, rotted meat and moldy produce, the yeasty scent of 1,000 departed brewskis, the odors of don't-care laziness, and the divinely sweet fir perfume of the woods just beyond the perimeter of this dirty little roadside store. He could hear the drone of a plane in some distant quadrant of the sky. He knew he loved Mr. Flannel's shirt because Mr. Flannel's shirt was here, was with them, linked to Roland and Eddie by the strongest of bonds for these few minutes. But time? No. He had no true sense of that. But it couldn't have been much more than 90 seconds since Roland had begun their retreat, or surely they would have been overwhelmed, crashed truck or no crashed truck. Roland pointed left, then turned right himself. He and Eddie stood back to back on the loading dock with about 6 feet between them, guns raised to their cheeks like men about to commence a duel. Mr. Flannel's shirt hopped off the end of the dock, spry as a cricket, and seized the chrome crank on the side of the old diesel pump. He began to spin it rapidly. The numbers in their little windows spun backward, but instead of returning to all zeros, they froze at 0019. Mr. Flannel's shirt tried the crank again. When it refused to turn, he shrugged and yanked the nozzle out of its rusty cradle. "John, no!" Chip cried. He was still standing in the doorway of his storeroom and holding up his hands, one clean and the other bloody all the way up the forearm. "Get out of the way, Chip, or you're gonna—" Two men dashed around Eddie's side of the East Stoneham General Store. Both were dressed in jeans and flannel shirts, but unlike Chip's shirt, these looked brand new, with the creases still in the sleeves. Purchased especially for the occasion, Eddie had no doubt. And one of the goons Eddie recognized quite well, had last seen him in the Manhattan restaurant of the Mind, Calvin Towers Bookshop. Eddie had also killed this fellow once before, 10 years in the future, if you could believe it, in the Leaning Tower, Balazar's joint, and with the same gun he now held in his hand. A snatch of old Bob Dylan lyric occurred to him, something about the price you had to pay to keep from going through everything twice. "Hey, Big Nose!" Eddie cried, as he seemed to each time he saw this particular piece of pond scum. "How you doing, pal?" In truth, George Biondi did not appear to be doing well at all. Not even his mother would have considered him much more than presentable, even on his best day, that humongous beak. And now his features were puffed and discolored by bruises that had only just begun to fade. The worst of them was right between the eyes. "I did that," Eddie thought, "in the back of Towers Bookstore." It was true, but it also seemed like something that had happened 1,000 years ago.
"You,"
said George Biondi. He seemed too stunned to even raise his gun.
"You. Here."
"Me. Here," Eddie agreed. "As for you, you should have stayed in New York."
With that said, he blew George Biondi's face off. His friend's face, too. Flannel's shirt squeezed the pump handle's pistol grip and dark diesel sprayed from the nozzle. It doused Chip, who cawed indignantly and then staggered out onto the loading dock.
"Stings!" he shouted. "Gorry, don't that sting! Quit it, John!"
John did not. Another 3 men came dashing around Roland's side of the store, took one look at the gunslinger's calm and awful face, tried to backtrack. They were dead before they could do more than get the heels of their new country walking shoes planted. Eddie thought of the half-dozen cars and the big Winnebago that had been parked across the street, and had time to wonder just how many men Balazar had sent on this little expedition. Certainly not just his own guys. How had he paid for the imports? He didn't have to, Eddie thought. Someone loaded him up with dough and told him to go buy the farm. As many out-of-town goons as he could get, and somehow convinced him the guys they were going after deserved that kind of coverage. From inside the store there came a dull, percussive thud. Soot blew out of the chimney and was lost against the darker, oilier cloud rising from the crashed pulp truck. Eddie thought somebody had tossed a grenade. The door to the storeroom blew off its hinges, walked halfway down the aisle surrounded by a cloud of smoke, and fell flat. Soon the fellow who'd thrown the grenade would throw another, and with the floor of the storeroom now covered in an inch of diesel fuel.
"Slow him down if you can," Roland said. "It's not wet enough in there yet."
"Slow down, Andolini?" Eddie asked. "How do I do that?"
"With your everlasting mouth," Roland cried, and Eddie saw a wonderful, heartening thing. Roland was grinning, almost laughing.
At the same time, he looked at Flannel's shirt, John, and made a spinning gesture with his right hand. Keep pumping. Jack! Eddie shouted. He had no idea where Andolini might be at this point, and so simply yelled as loud as he could. Having grown up ramming around Brooklyn's less savory streets, this was quite loud. There was a pause. The gunfire slowed and stopped.
Hey!
Jack Andolini called back. He sounded surprised, but in a good-humored way. Eddie doubted he was really surprised at all, and he had no doubt whatsoever that what Jack wanted was payback. He'd been hurt in the storage area behind Tower's bookshop, but that wasn't the worst of it. He'd also been humiliated.
Hey, Slick, are you the guy who was going to send my brains to Hoboken, then stuck a gun under my chin? Man, I got a mark there.
Eddie could see him making this rueful little speech, all the time gesturing with his hands, moving his remaining men into position. How many was that, 8? Maybe 10? They'd already taken out a bunch, God knew. And where would the remainder be? A couple on the left of the store, a couple more on the right. The rest with Monsieur Grenade's R.S. And when Jack was ready, those guys would charge right into the new shallow lake of diesel fuel. Or so Eddie hoped.
I've got the same gun with me today, he called to Jack. This time I'll jam it up your ass. How'd that be?
Jack laughed. It was an easy, relaxed sound. An act, but a good one. Inside, Jack would be redlining, heart rate up over 130, blood pressure up over 170. This was it, not just payback for some little punk daring to blindside him, but the biggest job of his stinking bad guy career, the Super Bowl. Balazar gave the orders, undoubtedly, but Jack Andolini was the one on the spot, the field marshal. And this time the job wasn't just beating up a dice-dopey bartender who wouldn't pay the vig on what he owed, or convincing some Yid jewelry store owner on Lenox Avenue that he needed protection. This was an actual war. Jack was smart, at least compared to most of the street hoods Eddie had met while doped up and running with his brother Henry. But Jack was also stupid in some fundamental way that had nothing to do with IQ scores. The punk who was currently taunting him had already beaten him once, and quite handily. But Jack Andolini had contrived to forget that. Diesel sloshed quietly over the loading dock and rippled along the old warped boards of the mercantile storeroom. John, a.k.a. Cy Yankee Flannel Shirt, gave Roland a questioning look. Roland responded by first shaking his head and then twirling his right hand again, more.
"Where's the bookstore guy, Slick?"
Andolini's voice, just as pleasant as before, but closer now. He'd crossed the road, then. Eddie put him just outside the store. Too bad diesel fuel wasn't more explosive.
"Where's Tower? Give him to us, and we'll leave you and the other guy alone until next time."
Sure, Eddie thought, and remembered something Susanna sometimes said in her best growling Detta Walker voice to indicate utter disbelief.
"Also, I won't come in your mouth or get any in your hair."